Hello and welcome to another edition of the In Context podcast. Today I'll behave myself. The only person I'm scared of in 20 schemes, it's Shabba. How are you doing, Shabs?
That's a terrible thing to say about somebody that you're scared of me. We both know that's not true.
Well, the only person after my wife I'm scared of.
The only reason you're scared is because I'll grass you up to your wife.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, great, Shabba. It's great to have you on. It's great to chat with you. Can you just explain a little bit about who you are and what you do?
And so I am Sharon Dickens, or Shabba, as everybody calls me. I'm Director of Women's Ministry for 20 Schemes. And so primarily my job is to disciple, train, mentor the women's workers at 20 Schemes. And so, like, that's my basic job definition, but I do train and mentor other women other than 20 Schemes women. Mm. So we have developed a course, we have a framework for our mentorship, and so our idea is to invest in those that are investing in others.
Right. Well, Ada just described you as an international speaker, conference speaker, author.
Gobby person, she's yeah. Not afraid to say something.
Pioneer.
Look, I've told you already, I'm not going to grass you up to your wife. Then you have to keep on up.
Yeah, but you've wrote a few books. I'll get told off because I should have said written or something. But you've wrote a few books. You are an international conference speaker. You go beyond Scotland. The oracle and all things to do with...
Why do you have to say these things? Freaking me out. I'm like, yeah. Oh no, what if he asks me a hard question?
Yeah, no, but it's good, isn't it? So often, there's been a lot on Christian social media recently about finding your voice, about a lot of women not giving a platform to share and be used and have their gifts seen and flourished and encouraged. And like, for me, that is a bit alien from the context that we're working with, because there's so many gifted women I know who are having their voices heard. So what I'm trying to get at within this podcast today is, what is it like? Have you always had this freedom to develop your gifts and this encouragement? Or were you ever stifled? Do you understand what a lot of these people are saying on social media at the moment?
I do. So in the early days, I've been saved a long time. Like, I don't know, 30-something years. And in the very beginning, I was saved in, like, a really small mission hole where it never occurred to me that, like, God hadn't saved you for a purpose. Like, you were there to serve because there was room to serve. And then when I grew up a little, it wasn't even, like, massively, like, and then started travelling, I realised pretty quickly two things I didn't fit in, because square peg, round hole. Like, in middle-class context, it was really frustrating because people would say things. So you'd find places to serve, and I would be on, like, a committee at church where we were doing stuff, and you would say something, and some middle-class guy behind you would go, what Sharon meant to say was. And you think, I'm an intelligent woman, like, I'm degree educated. I'm pretty sure I can articulate for myself. But also, in a lot of times, the opportunities to serve didn't really fit my gift setting. Mm. Like, I wanted to do more than make cups of tea. I've served in children's ministry when my kids were little, because I would take my kids along with me, but there wasn't a lot of opportunity. So I have been in churches where I've tried to speak to an elder, and he's, like, literally done the, you know, when they look at you like they're feared and they start, he actually, like, physically ran away. And so, I mean, it's a true story. Like, I mean, I wasn't even asking a hard question. I think there's this assumption that, like, because you're strong and you're feisty, that actually you must be rebellious, therefore, like, you're going to be a problem when you really weren't. And so for a lot of times, it felt like you were sitting, stifled's not the right word, just underused and frustrated. Like, so even if you didn't have a voice, there was nothing to do. And so I found the easiest way to deal with that was to go do things elsewhere. I think that's why a lot of women go and join parachurches, like, you know, organizations, because there's opportunity to serve where, like they've been given as a gift to the church and the church aren't using them. And so I worked for a long time in like what we would call second tier organizations, some Christian, some not, and I'd serve that way. But I sat in my pew like for a long time, really frustrated. And I got a couple of friends who are ministers and they would say, come, oh, as we'll use you. And, but you, it's difficult because you knew where you're supposed to be. So I knew I was supposed to be in the tray. And then waiting for a long time, no able to like serve you, thinking there's opportunities out there. Why don't I just go and take them? So there was that battle. And then even like, I mean, it took, I think, 6 months after Mez came. So he came in the September, and by October he was talking to me about the stuff that I was doing. And then by April the next year, the church were employing me. And so he clearly saw something, I don't know what, but like, he saw something. But it felt like a long time you were waiting for something to happen, like just sitting there, treading water, frustrated. And so I do think that's why a lot of us do all go and do this, all the other, like the parachurch stuff, because they're desperate for people to serve. And in your own church and in your own context, sometimes you're not seen as a provision or a gift to the church. You're just underutilized, which is a shame, considering half the congregation and more are women. Stifled is maybe not a word I would have used, but yeah, definitely frustrated and underused.
So you said you knew you had to be in Nidri. You felt that's where you were called to be. Do you think if Mez hadn't came as the pastor and you'd been employed, there'd have been a time where you left? Or if not, what was keeping you there, even though you felt frustrated and underused?
I think if he didn't come, there probably would have been a time where I asked God I asked God a lot if I could leave. So I would pray about it quite regularly. And I know that there's times where God's using the waiting to teach us something. And so, I mean, you can use all these fancy words that people do, like pushing doors. I don't want to do that. I mean, there was no point going anywhere unless the Lord was in it.
Yeah.
And I'd known from the very beginning, like, I'd been in, so the weird thing with Nidri is, I'd been in Nidri when I first got saved. Mm-hmm. And so I was part of, I suppose what you'd call it is a bit like an internship, like our internship, but at Edinburgh City Mission.
Right.
Because I'd got saved at one of their other mission halls, there was few places for me to serve, and they put me in Nidri. And so there was a background for me being in Nidri. I'd been there a long time. And I remember when we came back to Edinburgh, I wanted to be anonymous and sit in a pew. I managed that about 6 months. I was getting frustrated. And I couldn't deny how I got to Nidri, because I knew I was supposed to. I'd been at a Charlotte Chapel sermon when the current pastor was speaking there, and I'd been really convicted about where God wanted me to go. And I mean, I genuinely was. And I was really rebellious. I didn't want to go back because of the history. And I remember getting really frustrated at God and saying, because we were without a building at that time, saying to God, if you want me to go, then you need to clearly show me how I'm supposed to get there, because I didn't even know where they're worshipping. And then I got on the bus to go to work that morning and ended up sitting next to a woman that had been in Nidri for like 30 years, that I hadn't seen for ages. And she told me to go. And so when you've got that, on Sunday, she had her husband waiting on me, like, so that when I got there, I knew somebody. So for me, there was no doubt that God had wanted me there, but I couldn't work out why. And so it being so clear, I wouldn't have gone unless it was right. So I was there for obvious reasons. I just needed to work out what the obvious reasons were. And that took me a long time. So I think at some point I would have gone. I'm going to have to plug myself in. At some point I would have gone, but I think I wouldn't have gone unless I had clear direction. So I learned a lot in the waiting, though. Like, I'm not the most patient of people. But, 5 years is a long time to wait. Like, I learned a lot about, I mean, I was even more gobby before Mez met me. I would have probably left, but it would have taken God to move me.
So again, we need to remember God's providence in this, that the God uses these frustrations to grow us and develop us. But it still doesn't discount the fact that the church was failing to utilize a gifted Christian for that mission. And the concern for me is how many people in our churches are sat on the pews, men and women, who are being overlooked for gospel ministry. And it's just a sad thing to see, when we are in a small, tiny church in Middlesbrough, desperate for gifted people to come and serve, and there's so many people being overlooked in their community. So was there ever a point where you thought, oh, what's the point? Do you know what I mean? Shall I just remain anonymous on a pew?
I mean, I would really like to. Do you know that? It's that moment where, I mean, you must have had this, Ian, where you want to go and work at Tesco's because it's easier.
Yeah.
Like, we have these holiday churches you go to that you visit when you're having a break from where you're at. And it would be nice to sit in a pew for 5 minutes, but that's like, it's not, it would be 5 minutes. Mm. Like, God saved us for a purpose. And if we're truly saved, like, then we've got, like, we've been saved to glorify him in all that we do. And part of that is the way that we serve him. Mm. And so, I mean, I'd last 5 minutes. I couldn't just sit in a pew and listen to a sermon and not actually be impacted by it.
Yeah.
So I don't think any of us, like, have got a call to just sit there and tread water.
Mm.
Like, as Christians.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Although at times it does sound appealing.
You'd be bored for 5 minutes as well.
Yeah.
Like, the last 5 minutes and you're like, yeah, I'm done.
Yeah. So what we've done, we had years of frustration. We had years of feeling underused. And then you've had years of being overworked. So what was that transition like?
I want some balance. I want some balance. I always say that. There's the lies you tell yourself in ministry.
Yeah.
Just keep going until the holidays.
Yeah.
Like, you tell yourself, when I get more staff, it's going to be, like, amazing. And actually what happens is more staff just brings more issues. Like, so not, there's never, always, always overworked.
Yeah.
You know that.
Yeah. But you've done, like, remarkable, really, not just for Nidri, but throughout the world. You've been a great encouragement to my wife and many other female gospel workers. So what was the difficulties then? From, you knew you were gifted, you knew you had something to give to the church, to the community, and to Jesus. Now you're given this opportunity. What fears came? Because it's a bit different. Like, when I was at boxing, I didn't want to be on the bags. I wanted to spar. I want to get in the ring and spar. Then as soon as I was allowed in the ring to spar, I was like, oh, I'm getting hit now. This isn't as good as what I thought it was going to be.
Well, that probably, a bit Bez used to say me all the time, those tinted glasses gone now. Yeah. probably three things. My first thing would be, I constantly, probably for about the first decade, compared myself to what I think the elder should have picked as a women's worker.
Mm.
It took me a long time to that penny to drop that I was there for a reason. Fear a man, that was massive. So the whole, suddenly people that are part of your congregation were paying your wages. You felt like you had to, like, work super hard and then some, just to prove that you weren't slacking. What else was, that's probably the two things. And then, like, what was really hard? I think one of the hardest things was I'd been part of this fellowship for such a long time, and you think that you had really close friends.
Mm-hmm.
And then suddenly you're in this inside track where they think you've got a beeline to the elders, and you know stuff, and some of it is true, you do know stuff. And so a lot of the friendships that I would have had in the beginning were very different.
Mm.
So just that instantly changed it at church. Like, there's probably just a few, maybe even just one friendship that I had before I started working at church that I've still got, that's the same, that's maintained.
Mm.
which is quite sad, really, when you think about it. So it doesn't mean I'm not friends with them, because I am obviously friends with people at church, but it's different, because when you're doing pastoral stuff, you obviously kind of talk about things to people. And then they look at you thinking, do you know everything? And you're like, no, I didn't, honest. So probably those three things, like fear of man was probably the biggest thing, what you think everybody's thinking. And in comparison, even though you say you obviously realised you were gifted, I never really did.
Right.
So I never, I always just assumed Mes picked me because I was the only one that would say yes. And you laugh at that because you were saying, well, we were talking about this before you started recording about how many times you would ask women to do stuff and they say no.
Yeah.
And I always just assumed that Mes kept asking me to do stuff, not because he saw something that was gifted, but because I actually went, I only then.
Yeah.
And so it took me a long time to realise that that's not the reason why I was doing my job.
Yeah.
It's a bit weird.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's nice to speak with somebody with humility. It wasn't the same for me.
You know, like, well, I'm totally gifted. Take it over the
world. Why can't anyone say I'm the best man for the job?
No, I knew I wasn't the best for the job at all.
Yeah. Well, obviously you were. Obviously you were, because you're still there now. And again, I think that's something you mentioned there, wasn't it, that how much was humility, how much was not being given the opportunity, and how much was just like self-doubt and insecurity, thinking that, because you mentioned you were always comparing yourself to other people. Why was that? Why do you think that was?
You have this idea in your head of who would make this. So I think about this a lot, actually. We talk about, mostly because we did this in our course, and so I had to think about it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's because we have this idealistic picture of what a Christian woman should be. And I do not fit on that idealistic, when you look at me, you don't go, it's what I mean is from a cultural Christian perspective. Especially for scheme folk, I think we have this idea that gentle means like cucumber sandwiches and being a doormat. And never having a voice or speaking out or being like gobby. So we have this idea of she's not feisty, she's meek. So this idea of who that is, this picture of what a godly woman is, which isn't biblical, it's cultural. And so I didn't fit that, screw peg round hole. So in my head, even though I knew it wasn't a biblical image, it's what's portrayed as, and it's what people think as. And so I know that when Mes employed me, he got a lot of pushback for taking the gobby, feisty, independent, divorced woman who's got a single parent. I mean, she's not exactly the poster model for godly women on the surface. And so I know that he got a lot of flack for that. And I mean, people would say, well, you obviously can't speak into my life because you're not married. And I'm like, well, I think you'll find the Bible's the one that's speaking, and I can't say that. So it's that I did have that compare myself, because even in my own head, I didn't live up to that fake picture of what a godly woman is. I'd not had an uncomplicated life.
Yeah. So do you think you had the added burden of not only being a woman who would have been underused regardless of her background, it was also your cultural background that kind of, it was like kind of two wars you were fighting. It was the fact that you were a female gospel worker, but also because you come from a scheme background, or you're divorced.
Yeah, there's all that. I mean, you're a woman for a start in a man's world. And you're right, culturally, it's really weird. I spent a lot of my time in the Christian world not feeling out of place, because I don't really understand middle-class suburbia. You know when they talk for about 20 minutes but say nothing? And you know when you're like
this podcast.
Thanks for that.
No, I'm on about me, not you, Sharon.
In that whole passive-aggressive, that we just, I mean, if somebody asks you a question, you're like, answer it. I couldn't work it out. The whole time I felt confused. And I'd been in church plants that were in what would be classed as schemes.
Yeah.
They were predominantly middle class people and I didn't understand the culture. So I felt very out of place. So yeah, you're right, there's a lot of things.
Mm.
It wasn't just because like I was, yeah, probably a lot of things playing into that, why it's different.
Yeah. And again, did you find any pushback from other women in the church? I know you mentioned about relationships being different, but was there any pushback about women who thought women shouldn't be in ministry?
No. I think the pushback we would have got was what type of ministry it was.
Right.
So again, like, we didn't, the ministry that we've got, so women's ministry culturally, whatever part of the world you're in, I've seen this, is very much events driven by someone that's driving that. So the women's worker drives a bunch of events, people come and they all hang out together. And so I didn't do that because I didn't, it's not culturally where I come from. So when we set up our women's ministry, it's discipleship and relationship based, which is very different. But that's how our culture functions. So everything that we do is based on that foundation. And so from our new Christians, from the like our new convert Christians from the schemes, they never thought that weird, but we did get a lot of pushback on our discipleship culture from existing church.
Yeah.
So it was more about the pushback I got was more for the way the ministry was run rather than they thought having a women's worker was great.
Yeah.
Well, nobody said it to my face. They might have thought it was rubbish, but they never said it to my face.
Yeah, it's something that fascinates me because, again, the church I went to when I was first saved didn't have a pastor. The person who discipled me was female. She shared the gospel with me. I'd known her since I was a kid. And all the people on the council estate who loved Jesus, who shared the gospel, were females. One woman, she was the church evangelist, but there was no pastor. But the majority of people in the community who were Christians were female, and definitely the only people who shared the gospel in the community were female. So yeah, it's just unique to me to hear just culturally so differently. Again, I was raised by a single parent, I married a single parent, I've seen the gifts of women and the strength and the ease at which a lot of women build relationships in our context. So it was like, it's just second there. It was never anything I thought about having women working. In fact, the charity that I first set up in the church I planted was alongside my wife. And maybe probably my danger was being too egalitarian rather than strict complementarian. So this is something that fascinates me, like within the church. So what happens next? Then you're working as a woman's worker in a tiny little church in Nidri, and the next minute you're flying out to the States to.
It's a fucking scary thing, eh?
Yeah.
It wasn't the instant. I mean, it feels like it's instant.
Yeah.
So the things that what makes me sad is that they'll fly me all over the world to speak about women's ministry, but nobody in Scotland. Well, few people in Scotland would invite me. There are some really amazing wee groups out there. There's a wee group up in Harris that always invite me, and Lewis. But yeah, it's weird. Like it's harder in the UK than it is abroad. And so the first time, go for it.
Sorry. So I thought it would have been the opposite way. I thought the pushback would have been greater in America than in the UK. Because to me, it seems natural. So
in the UK, most of the time in the UK, like when we went to the FIEC conference a couple of years ago. It must have been like 5-6 years ago. It was amazing. And Mez was supposed to do 3 sessions in the mornings. And he gave me and Andy a session each. And my last session was on women's ministry. Mm-hmm. And I spoke for an hour. And it was the last session of the last day before they were all going home. And they queued for an hour and a half afterwards to ask me questions.
Yeah.
And it's nuts. And so when we did that big thing in London, mind we went and we did that big 829 thing.
Mm.
And it was the same. They put me on before lunch and we had an hour for lunch. And at 5 minutes before the lunch break was over, the last person in the queue like ask me a question. So they queue for a long time to ask a question because they're mostly what we get in the UK, and we get this actually everywhere I go, this is what happens. They are desperate to do something, they just didn't know how to do it well. And so when we go to the States in the very beginning, it was just, you were going to a bunch of, like, we're doing women's conferences, talking about women's ministry and discipleship. And everybody would say things like, oh, I desperately want to do stuff like that. And so that was different. Now when I do a big platform, like, it's the same thing, whether it's the small group for like 50 people or there's 600 or 6,000. When I do the queue and ask me the same questions. So whether you're in the States or Canada or like in some random part of, like, where do we go with the FIC, then somewhere south in the UK, they all say the same thing. We desperately want to do this, we just don't know how. And how do you do this well in a complementarian context without becoming independent? Like, and then they say, can you train our women? And I'm like, sometimes I say, aye, all right then. And sometimes I say, no, I really can't, but I can give you some resources.
Yeah.
So, I mean, wherever we go, it's the same. But the platform never started with the big things. It all started with like 30 people in. Well, you can watch like 30 people in a room asking you a bunch of questions.
Yeah. So, again, there's having... giving somebody a slot to chat about women's ministry and saying we want to do something, and maybe he's even doing something, having the women's worker. But how do you avoid tokenism? How do you avoid, not so much how do you avoid tokenism? Yeah, two questions. How do you avoid tokenism? And how do you encourage like godly relationship and learning between men and women within the church? So it's like a kind of mutual thing. How can we learn from one another? And not just have you making cups of tea.
Why do you never ask easy questions? We had a rule. So chuck me a header if you ask me easy questions. I think our elders did it well. Like, so I was thinking about this recently because I just wrote a book about this, how we did our women's ministry. It's at Christmas. But one of the things I was reflecting on is how our elders did this well. And I think it was... what was really interesting was our elders, we would say they gave me enough rope to hang myself, but they didn't. Like, what they did is they said, this is, we want you to create a women's ministry. And then they had high expectations of what they wanted to. So it wasn't, they weren't tokenistic. They were just, they really saw and grasped and got the fact that actually, we've been saved for a purpose and we have a fundamental part to play in a congregation. And so that was our starting point. And then there was some really difficult questions to ask, like what happens when, or like, what will it look like? And then we debated that for a long time. And so I reviewed all our women's, or anything that was remotely classed as women's ministry. I reviewed it and I came up with a plan, and then I would have to go to the elders meeting on a Monday night, and they would like bash it around, ask me questions. Have you thought about, you need to go and think about this. And they did that for a long time. So they asked some really hard questions before, for over a year before we actually started really doing anything. So at the same time, I was still like doing one-to-ones with people. So I would have done the standard, I saw everybody, but I think that was probably, that's the most significant thing, I think, is our elders. I don't think it's, I think our elders saw that we were valued, saw that we had a serious role to play, and then said, right, let's ask the hard questions and work out what that looks like in our context. And I think that's what, when I go places and go other, all people see is a bunch of problems. And I'm like, yeah, you're right. There is a bunch of problems. There's questions you're going to have to answer. But you need to start chewing the big stuff over. And it takes time. And so I think that's the most important thing, I think, was our elders. Like, if they'd not given it way or had high expectations of what they expected, or then we wouldn't have even remotely been the ministry that we are now. It doesn't matter how gifted. I mean, I could have been super lead, duper lead gifted. Without them, it would have been useless. So I would say that was the most significant thing. Elders that had like a vision, high expectations, and weren't afraid to answer the hard questions.
And again, I'm trying to be very careful, not to offend you because you know me, but anyone who might be listening who misinterprets what I'm saying. But again, where do you stand? Where does your church stand on women discipling men, encouraging men? Is there a because obviously women, if they're in a children's group, they're discipling young children, aren't they? So is there a cut-off age? Or is there a mutual edification that we see within the church between men and women?
We're pretty clear in our context. Mm-hmm. Like, so guys can speak well and need to into my life. Mm-hmm. So, like, well, you know that. We've known each other for a long time. Mm-hmm. But the ones who want us, like, really invest and be intimately involved in my life are women. Mm. And so it's just because we run a women's ministry that's like women disciple women and men disciple men doesn't mean that they haven't got something to say into another's life.
Yeah.
It just means that it's done within a framework that's wise and safe. Mm. And so discipleship isn't about, I mean, even though we call it one-to-one, I mean, you know, because you do the same as us, that like when you're bringing up a new believer, there's not just one person that's speaking into that life. If it's a female, guys need to do that also. And there's a lot of times where some of our young interns or even our older interns that are vaguely the same age as me, they'll ask me questions, but I speak to them with a motherly tone and then send them back to their one-to-one.
Yeah.
To do it within a wise framework. Yeah, I'm going to listen to you because I care about you. But actually, the one that really needs to invest in you is your one-to-one. So have you spoke to them and send them back? So I don't have a problem with it being that way. Yeah. It's not, on paper, it might look like it's in isolation, but discipleship isn't. It's within a caring family church context. And so we're a body of believers all invested in each other's lives. So there's no real... It's about what that investment looks like. And some cases it's more intense than others, as it should be, I think.
Yeah.
Titus is pretty clear about who invests and grows up younger women. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. That probably doesn't answer your question, but that's what you're getting.
All right, well, it answers a couple of other questions and touches on the one I was talking about. And again, I think there's that fear, isn't there, of, for me, what I was trying to tease out is, that fear of a woman having authority over a man within the church, which fair enough, but where is the boundary between somewhat learning from one another and having authority over one another?
So I teach my girls this all the time. So we have young interns that come in and they're 5 years old. Yeah. Sometimes they're 5 minutes old. Now, like in the real worlds, they might be the same age as me. But we have this it drives me nuts about us women. We whinge when guys won't step up, and we expect that when they're saved that they instantly become the best leaders on the planet. Mm. That doesn't mean that. So as a woman speaking into that situation, even though like I would be an older, more mature woman, if there's a guy that's been maybe put in charge of like a ministry like our cafe, like how I deal with that and how it's a different kind of submitting his authority because he's not my elder and he's not my husband. Yeah. But like how you teach him, there's something in how you deal with that where the younger women around you watch how you interact. Mm. You can teach the guy how to lead well by how you do that well. And there's so much that you can be brought to bear in that situation just by speaking well and wisely. But that doesn't mean that I'm his one-to-one, but that doesn't mean as a motherly older woman in the faith, I don't have something to speak to this child, because that's really what they are, baby. Yeah. Christians. And teach them how to lead women well and in a right and a really biblical way. We had this one incident where it was a really simple thing. We had a weekender and it was crazy because you've been to weekenders. Mm-hmm. And I was serving food at the time where we used to do it at the snooker table. And the guy that was running, the intern that was in charge, kicked off with me because I used the wrong ladle. Like, and my heater was like, who the flipping heck do you think you are? Actually, what come out my mouth was, I understand what you're saying. Yeah. I'll make sure that I do it proper later. But like one of my girls turned around and said to me, why didn't you go mad at him? And I'm like, well, one, it wouldn't have been biblical, but two, you have to understand his situation. He's stressed. He's not dealing with the responsibility well. Like there was a ton of eyes watching, so they're watching how you respond to that. Now that didn't mean that 3 days later, like when we're in the car going to like Booker's, the thing I said to them, turned around and said to them, can we just talk about how you spoke to me about the other day there? Let's have a talk about that. And we had to talk about how it wasn't appropriate the way. And so again, it's that you got just got to do it well and wisely.
Yeah.
I don't know if that answers your question anymore, Ian. The teasing out of what.
Yeah, no, I think it does. Yeah, I think it was helpful because I think what it shows is everyone in the church should have humility towards one another, should show grace, should show mercy, should be encouraging. But and I think that's the biggest problem. You talk a lot about wisdom, and I think that's where the failure in the church is. Not much common sense is used when looking at this type of ministry. If only we just looked at the Bible and used a bit of common sense, I think the distinction between our roles would be a lot easier to manage. Would you agree?
Sure. Actually, for sure. We've not got any common sense, though.
Yeah, yeah. And a lot of fear. And I think justified fear of not wanting to be unbiblical, but I think we shouldn't be ruled by fear and let that restrict our ministries.
That's very true.
So that we have leaders, church leaders, who are fearful of making wrong calls with regarding women's ministry. What fears does somebody who's heading up a women's ministry have then?
Thanks, Ian. Millions. Millions. I do feel overly responsible for everything.
Yeah.
But I know that that's like part of that is my sinfulness. You used the word trailblazer earlier. I didn't even know if that's the right word, but being one of the first things is always scary.
Yeah.
So you're scared that, and people quote you, that freaks me out. Like you said at a you'll get an email going, you said at a conference this.
Yeah.
Like I just want to debate it. Or like I wrote a blog and they, like somebody emails me about it. And like, so that those things, it's the biggest fear is I don't want to, you're fearful is like the right word, but in the wrong context. I don't want to be fearful to the point that it stops me doing anything. But like, I don't want to bring the Lord's name in vain. So I don't want to cause, like, I don't want to diminish the gospel or say the wrong thing. It's one of the things that worries me about being on a stage that I say something completely heretical. oh wait, rubbish just came out my mouth. So I'm fearful of that. So when you get that I find hard because you've got nobody to ask.
Yeah.
Like so it's different now because we're 15 years in. But in the early days, when you're the only person doing this, you're like, there's no benchmark. There's nothing to judge it off of. There's no one to go and say, I've got this really complex situation. How do you do that? and so a lot of the times we were trying to work it out as we went along. So it was difficult. But now we've got there's a bit more of us out there. And so it's easier to ask what's worked in your context. So, yeah, fearful of making a massive mistake and bringing like dishonour on God. Stuffing up the ministry and causing 20 schemes issues. I'm always like aware that I'm quite, because I am feisty, and when I get annoyed, like my gob opens and it comes out. And I have seen Matthew, our American director, go red, as you know, you've said something. And so the feisty, so that, like you're fearful of like damaging the ministry in some way, shape, or form. But more than anything, like, I mean, that verse, like, when you're doing anything where there's like young Christians involved or you're discipling, you just don't want to be a bad witness.
Yeah.
You don't want to be a bad example. You don't want to be a bad witness. Like all those things that you wouldn't want to do, teach somebody something that's unhelpful, be an ungodly or an unhelpful witness. So there's loads to be scared of.
Yeah.
And then like, if you just totally get it wrong and you make a mistake, like anybody else, So yeah, when we were building our ministries, all those things, the big things were into play. Fearfully, you just got it wrong. Like, I've stopped listening to what people say. I don't mean that. What I mean is I've stopped listening or reading the comments that people make on things that are right. Yeah. So, you know, the blogs, I don't look at comments. Yeah. I ask our guys not to send me them. Yeah. They don't have my email so that people can't respond to me. Because it used to just crush me. Mm. People would say, oh, what you said did this. And I'd be like, no, I can't cope with that. Yeah. Like, so in that sense, when it's all blogged in Twitter, I don't do Twitter, as you know. You can slag me off all you like on Twitter, I'm not paying attention. So there's things that I've had to do because those things I find difficult to listen to. But like, again, it'd be back to that. When you asked me earlier, what are the fears? It would be fear of man. Yeah. And so I have to protect myself from like indulging that sinfulness. So yeah, that would be my biggest fears when I was building stuff, just getting it wrong. Like, nobody else to copy off.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to have these. I spoke with Stephanie Greer the other week, and I'm not wanting to project myself as being this really woke man who gets it and make myself out to be a hero. So again, I'm struggling in trying to encourage women and not push them when they like. There's a hesitancy between you don't want to push people beyond what they can manage or handle, but neither do you want to, but you do want to push them out of the comfort zone.
Yeah.
So what is the best way for a man to, like, me and you have got like a pretty good relationship, as in we can say what we think.
We do.
is it always best to be, is it just because of our personalities? What's the best way, or do you have to just see it person by person?
I think you have to see it person by person. I think the thing to, so yes, when you asked that question earlier about were you frustrated and all these things, the answer is yes. Like, there's not a role. But actually, I mean, as women, we need to take responsibility for this as well. So the trouble is, like, our elders, and I've seen this in many churches all over the place, they continually ask their women to do stuff and they say no. And for lots of reasons, and some of it really justifiable. Like, I mean, if you've got young kids, you're working and you've got young kids, you might not feel like you've got the gift. And there's all these things, reasons for saying no. But I mean, if God has saved us for a purpose and we are active members in their congregations, there's always something that we can do. Mm-hmm. Even if it's the smallest thing. So like this, I would find that in the very beginning, when we go places, women are invited to participate and they don't. Mm. And so we would challenge ours. It's different. I mean, you would say to them, like, boot up or shut up. Like, I mean, we've got no right to moan if you're continually asked.
Yeah.
You continually say no. But I think that, like, being understanding about how and practical and the realities of how much they can serve, that's a different thing.
Mm.
But like, which is why when we were encouraging our ladies with one-to-one, like, they don't have to take on 15 women, but every single woman in our congregation can take on one woman and be really intentional in her life well. And if they've not got space for one woman, then there's something going on with their lives.
Yeah.
Like, there's balance that needs to be reflected on, because everybody, like, no matter who they are, we've got space for one person in our life.
Yeah.
Like, one person. And so it's that reality of sometimes that when I ask women, it wasn't that they were, even when they were saying no, it's I always see that as the beginning of a negotiation. what I mean is sometimes if you find out why they're saying no, it's really easy to overcome. And it might be that they don't understand what's being asked, or they need to be trained in that role, or they're not confident. Those are things that can be worked through. Mm. But yeah, I think part of, yeah, I think it's difficult because I think it's a two-way thing.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, that, again, humility and putting Jesus before preference again, isn't it? Yes. I think, and what's right. But Shabba, it's been fantastic catching up. It's been awesome. We'll have to meet again shortly and plug this book that we're planning on writing. We'll have to meet and discuss how we're going to write it first as well, won't we?
I need to finish the proposal first. Once we've done the proposal, then you can get to write it.
Yeah.
I was laughing at you. You're like, oh, I've seen the chapter headers. Let's start writing now. Like,
what? It was because I had a week of a quiet week. I thought, if I start now, I know it's not getting done for another 5 years unless I start.
Well, do you know what? When we started that, you'll have a choice. There'll be a deadline.
Yeah.
Only six chapters you've got to write. Just.
Oh, awesome. Sharon, thanks very much for joining me on the In Context podcast. See you soon.
Take care.